Have you ever wondered why so much of Africa, seen through modern-day media, appears much less westernized or urbanized? Well, we're here today to explore the intense history of imperialism and see how it still shapes our world today. Our story will begin in the 1800s when King Leopold II of Belgium began discussing his thoughts on Belgian expansion. He wrote a letter to his brother, Prince Philip, saying,
"The country must be strong, prosperous, therefore have colonies of her own, beautiful and calm."
At that time, explorer Henry Morton Stanley had set off to explore the entirety of Africa. After visiting what is now known as the Democratic Republic of the Congo, he claimed that the area
is and will be the grand highway of commerce to West Central Africa.
So naturally, Leopold set his sights on what is now known as the Democratic Republic of the Congo, renaming it the Congo Free State. With the help of Stanley, Leopold was able to successfully claim the Congo by making Congo chiefs sign more than 450 treaties. The Constitutional Rights Foundation states, clearly they had no idea what they were signing in exchange for the cloth, trinkets, alcohol, and other cheap goods Stanley gave them. After lobbying in the U.S., the United States was the first region to validate their claim to the land. According to Wikipedia, by a resolution passed in the Belgian Parliament, Leopold became
roi souverain,
or sovereign king, of the newly formed CFS, over which he enjoyed nearly absolute control. How did he do this? Leopold was an expert in manipulation and a champion in racist teachings. He told other world leaders he would bring civilization into Africa and improve the living conditions of the inhabitants. He, as it turns out, was lying. Leopold's exploitation of the land and people eventually led to the Berlin Conference, or the Scramble for Africa, which led to the same kind of exploitation nearly everywhere in the continent, all of which were controlled by different European countries. While we are not going to do a deep dive into the treatment of African citizens, it is important to note that their living conditions were unimaginably bad due to the hard labor and punishments they lived through. We wanted to take a different approach on their narrative, however, and talk about examples of successful rebellion and celebrate the victories of those people. To quote Nigel Toussaint, an undergraduate student at Bowling Green State University, Ethiopia was an oddity when it came to colonial Africa. It was the only African nation that managed to successfully repel European invaders with military force. The Italians had allied themselves with Menelik II, who was the emperor in Ethiopia at the time, in the hopes that he would give over his land in exchange for gifted items, particularly weapons. By the time the Italians declared the land theirs and attempted to invade from Eritrea, Menelik had already compiled an army of over 100,000 soldiers, and they were able to resist Italian expansion in what is now known as the Battle of Adwa. According to Toussaint, one of the biggest failures of African resistance was the lack of modern technology. Most of Africa still used spears or machetes to fight, and if they did have guns, they were old, outdated, and poorly maintained. As a result, Africans did not stand much of a chance against modern European military technology, so it is clear that Ethiopia was able to remain a free state because they had these items and strategized in advance. Ultimately, any resistance, regardless of its success, was a bold act. Khan Academy states, "Most resistance is invisible to us today. It didn't take the form of big battles or dramatic campaigns. It happened when workers slowed down their work, or people gave fake directions to visiting colonial officials and got them lost, or clerks sabotaged and lied on forms. These were acts of extreme bravery in times of grave danger, and it is important that these people's legacies live on too." Imperialism's history is not just limited to Africa. Let's shift to China and talk about the Opium Wars.
The Opium Wars marked a long history of Chinese humiliations and defeats. The Opium Wars started because of the Chinese Kohong system. The Chinese Kohong system was mainly used in southern ports and allowed Chinese to regulate the prices of things coming in out of their country and ensured power over their trade. The British, however, really hated this, so they started illegally shipping opium from India to China because they realized that opium was a highly addictive drug. The Chinese then began to become addicted to opium and caused a myriad of social and economic problems in southern China. Some of these economic problems included the depletion of silver bullion. Because some Chinese authorities were corrupt, they turned a blind eye to these things because they were getting paid. But the problems in the South and the depleted silver bullion was a problem, so they began to start cracking down on the opium trade. Some things that they tried to do to mitigate the opium trade was by employing Lin Zixiu to destroy crates of opium. Lin Zixiu destroyed 2,000 crates of opium on the beaches of Guangzhou. In the spring of 1839, the Chinese government confiscated and destroyed more than 20,000 chests of opium, some 1,400 tons of the drug that were warehoused at Canton by British merchants. Later, the antagonism between the two sides increased in July when some drunken British sailors killed a Chinese villager, and because the British didn't want their people to be tried under the Chinese legal system, they refused to turn in the accused men to the Chinese courts. So this really inflamed the tensions between Britain and China. So after Lin Zixiu's initial attempts to try to destroy opium crates, the British got really upset, and so they began to send troops into Chinese ports. The Chinese began to realize the differences in their naval technology, and they began struggling with defending their own ports. These hostilities broke out later in that year when the British warships destroyed a Chinese blockade on the Pearl River at Hong Kong, and the British government decided in the early 1840s to send an expeditionary force to China, which arrived in Hong Kong in June. The British fleet then proceeded up the Pearl River to Canton, and then after months of negotiations there, attacked and occupied the city in May 1841. This marked the beginning of a series of long attempts to try to capture Chinese ports. The last attempt to capture a Chinese port was the capture of Nanjing, which also ended the Opium War. At Nanjing, they signed the Nanjing Treaty, and then later the British Supplementary Treaty of Humen. The Nanjing Treaty basically opened 5 ports to the British government and gave Hong Kong to Britain as a permanent base of operations, so it became a colony of Britain. And this Treaty of Humen, signed October 8, 1843, gave British citizens extraterritoriality, which is basically the right to be tried by the British courts rather than the Chinese courts. And it also granted Britain the most favored nation status, which was basically China granting Britain any rights that might be granted over to foreign countries, so Britain had more power in China.
I did a lot in attempt to limit opium trade in China. For example, I wrote Queen Victoria to protest the opium trade in 1839. I outlawed opium trade and consumption, and I destroyed opium cargoes. All those people in China who sell opium or smoke opium should receive the death penalty. If we trace the crime of those barbarians who through the years have been selling opium, then the deep harm they have wrought and the great profit they have absurd should fundamentally justify their execution according to law.
Here is a short reading of the Nanjing Treaty.
It is agreed that the total amount of $21 million described in 3 preceding articles shall be paid as follows. 6 million immediately. 6 million in 1843, that is 3 million on or before the 30th of the month of June and 3 million on or before the 31st of December. 4 million in 1845, that is 2 million on or before the 30th of June and 2 million before or on the 31st of December, and is further stipulated that the interest of the rate of 5% per annum shall be paid by the government of China on any portions of the above sums that are not punctually discharged at the periods fixed. So this treaty really demonstrated that the British thought they had superiority over China and really illuminated how money-hungry and greedy the British were to get their hands on the Chinese economy and their port.
Some consequences of the First Opium War is the weakening of the Chinese dynastic system and some economic issues because their trade was at the hands of Western powers in which they opened ports and signed a series of unequal treaties which led to the depletion of silver bullion. Social issues were also a consequence in the southern areas of China, and it led to the Second Opium War by demonstrating to European powers the influence of opium, especially that they had a possession that weakened the Chinese government and they could use it for their own imperial ambitions.
So, after discussing the events of the Belgian Congo as well as the Opium War, how are these events still relevant today? Well, imperialism still impacts these countries on a global scale, and how they interact in the economic and political realm. For example, in the Belgian Congo, now known as the Democratic Republic of the Congo, cement is poured into the uranium mine so that the Congolese cannot get to it. However, VIP rich people still have ways to exploit this resource. Thousands of young miners smuggle this material to mainly North Korea and China. Another example is coltan. It is vital to modern life, as it's found in cell phones, computer chips, global communications, transportation, and defense. In 2003, the UN had an inquiry made into the exploitation of natural resources in the Congo. They found some criminal and terrorist organizations, military regimes, and transnational corporations that claimed that they were helping the DRC. However, they named 150 companies who were actually exploiting the DRC for their natural resources. The Congolese only want some sort of peace and economic stability. However, this is very hard to attain due to the constant economic exploitation in the modern world, which is stemmed from the legacy of imperialism in the Belgian Congo. So, how does the Opium War affect modern China today? Well, many Chinese people consider the Opium War a period of sorrow and humiliation because the Opium War was one of the main factors for the downfall of the Qing Dynasty and the rise of the Communist Party. Because this period is considered one of humiliation, it is a legitimacy for the reason why China reacts to the West in certain ways on economic and political decisions. It is a catalyst for the reasons for why China reacts certain ways and is constantly looming over the Chinese government as they make political decisions, as this defeat to foreigners when China historically considers themselves the strongest empire is too humiliating and they must somehow redeem themselves and reassert that they are stronger than the Qing dynasty and that they will overcome and that they have the strength and will assert themselves in the political sphere once more.
All right, that's it. You made it to the end. We hope you learned something. Imperialism was a very dark part of our history, and it's clear that economic exploitation is still occurring in the modern world. Many large corporations and fast fashion brands profit off of this said exploitation. Supporting smaller businesses and thinking carefully about the impacts of your corporate purchases makes a small but mighty impact on supporting anti-imperialist efforts. Thank you for listening.